And by an odd accident, America had produced in President Roosevelt, who was president from 1901 to 1908, a man of an energy as restless as the German Kaiser's, as eager for large achievements, as florid and eloquent, an adventurous man with a turn for world politics and an instinct for armaments, the very man we might imagine to have involved his country in the scramble for overseas possessions. There doesn't appear to be any other explanation of this general restraint and abstinence on the part of the United States except in their fundamentally different institutions and traditions. In the first place, the United States government has no foreign office and no diplomatic corps of the European type, no body of experts to maintain the tradition of an aggressive policy. The president has great powers, but they are subject to the control of the Senate, which again is responsible to the state legislatures and the people. The foreign relations of the country are thus under open and public control. Secret treaties are impossible under such a system, and foreign powers complain of the difficulty and uncertainty of understandings with the United States, a very excellent state of affairs. The United States is constitutionally incapacitated, therefore, from the kind of foreign policy that has kept Europe for so long constantly on the verge of war. And, secondly, there has hitherto existed in the States no organization for and no tradition of what one may call non-assimilable possession. Where there is no crown, there can't be crown colonies. In spreading across the American continent, the United States had developed a quite distinctive method of dealing with the new territories, admirably adapted for unsettled lands, but very inconvenient if applied too freely to areas already containing an alien population. This method was based on the idea that there can't be in the United States system a permanently subject people. The first stage of the ordinary process of assimilation had been the creation of a territory under the federal government, having a considerable measure of self-government, sending a delegate who couldn't vote to Congress, and destined in the natural course of things, as the country became settled and population increased, to flower at last into full statehood. This had been the process of development of all the latter states of the Union, the latest territories to become states being Arizona and New Mexico in 1910. The frozen wilderness of Alaska, bought from Russia, remained politically undeveloped simply because it had an insufficient population for state organization. As the annexations of Germany and Great Britain in the Pacific threatened to deprive the United States Navy of coaling stations in that ocean, a part of the Samoan Islands in 1889 and the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii, were annexed in 1898. Here, for the first time, the United States had real subject populations to deal with, but in the absence of any class comparable to the Anglo-Indian officials who sway British opinion, the American procedure followed the territorial method. Every effort was made to bring the educational standards of Hawaii up to the American level, and a domestic legislature on the territorial pattern was organized so that these dusky islanders seemed destined ultimately to obtain full United States citizenship. The small Samoan islands are taken care of by a United States naval administrator. In 1895 occurred a quarrel between the United States and Britain upon the subject of Venezuela, and the Monroe Doctrine was upheld stoutly by President Cleveland. Then Mr. Olney made this remarkable declaration: "Today the United States is practically sovereign on this continent, and its fiat is law upon the subjects to which it confines its interposition." This, together with the various Pan-American congresses that have been held, point to a real open foreign policy of alliance and mutual help throughout America. treaties of arbitration hold good over all that continent, and the future seems to point to a gradual development of interstate organization, a Pax Americana, of the English-speaking and Spanish-speaking peoples, the former in the role of elder brother. Here's something we can't even call an empire, something going far beyond the great alliance of the British Empire in the open equality of its constituent parts. Consistently with this idea of a common American welfare, the United States in 1898 intervened in the affairs of Cuba, which had been in a state of chronic insurrection against Spain for many years. A brief war ended in the acquisition of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippine Islands. Cuba is now an independent, self-governing republic. Puerto Rico and the Philippines have, however, a special sort of government, with a popularly elected lower house and an upper body containing members appointed by the United States Senate. It's improbable that either Puerto Rico or the Philippines will become states in the Union. They are much more likely to become free states in some comprehensive alliance with both English-speaking and Latin America. Both Cuba and Puerto Rico welcomed the American intervention in their affairs, but in the Philippine Islands there was a demand for complete and immediate freedom after the Spanish War, and a considerable resistance to the American military administration. There it was that the United States came nearest to imperialism of the great power type, and that her record is most questionable. There was much sympathy with the insurgents in the States. Here's the point of view of ex-President Roosevelt as he wrote it in his autobiography of 1913. As regards the Philippines, my belief was that we should train them for self-government as rapidly as possible and then leave them free to decide their own fate. I didn't believe in setting the time limit within which we would give them independence because I didn't believe it wise to try to forecast how soon they would be fit for self-government, and once having made the promise, I would have felt that it was imperative to keep it. Within a few months of my assuming office, we had stamped out the last armed resistance in the Philippines that wasn't of merely sporadic character, and as soon as peace was secured, we turned our energies to developing the islands and the interests of the natives. We established schools everywhere. We built roads. We administered an even-handed justice. We did everything possible to encourage agriculture and industry, and in constantly increasing measure, we employed natives to do their own governing and finally provided a legislative chamber. We are governing and have been governing the islands in the interests of the Filipinos themselves. If after due time the Filipinos themselves decide that they don't wish to be thus governed, then I trust that we will leave. But when we do leave, it must be distinctly understood that we retain no protectorate, and above all, that we take part in no joint protectorate over the islands, and give them no guarantee of neutrality or otherwise, that in short, we are absolutely quit of responsibility for them, of every kind and description.